were black and white marble squares laid out like a game board. The ceilings in the rooms we passed were a good 12 feet high, rimmed with plaster garlands and strange imps peering down at us. The walls in the hallway were covered in dark red silk, padded to dampen sound. I was so intent on my survey, I nearly bumped into a door. The butler bustled on, ignoring me discreetly when I yelped in surprise. He ushered me into the library and pulled the double doors together as he left the room. A large oriental rug spread a soft mauve pattern across the parquet floor. On the left, the room was anchored by a massive antique desk of mahogany and teak, inlaid with brass. The furniture, an oversized sofa and three solidly constructed armchairs, was upholstered in burgundy leather. The room was functional, fully used, not some tidy assemblage designed to impress. I could see file cabinets, a computer setup, a fax machine, a copier, and a four-line telephone. Mahogany shelves on three walls were lined with books, one section devoted to film scripts with titles inked across the visible end. On the fourth floor, wall-to-ceiling windows overlooked the walled grounds in the rear, where the party was in full swing. The noise level had risen, but the brunt of it was muted by the mullioned panes. I stood at the windows and looked down at the crowd below. Sections of the immense garden had been tented for the occasion, the red canvas glowing with candlelight. Tall propane heaters had been placed along the perimeter to warm the chilly night air. Tiny bulbs had been strung through all the saplings on the property. Every branch was defined by pinpoints of illumination. Tables had been covered in red satin cloths. The centerpieces were arrangements of dark red roses and carnations. Folding chairs were swaddled in clouds of red netting. I could see the caterers were still setting up a cold midnight supper. Blood sausage, no doubt. The invitations must have specified the dress requirements. The men wore black tuxedos, and all the women wore full or cocktail-length dresses in red or black. The women were slim, and their hair was ornamental, dyed that strange California blonde affected by women over 50. Their faces seemed perfect, though by dint of surgery they all appeared to be much the same age. I suspect that none of these people were the cream of San Francisco society. These folk were the rich milk who had risen as close to the top of the bottle as money and ambition permitted in the course of one generation. My guess was that even as they drank, eyeing the buffet tables, they were trashing the host and hostess.
"If you're hungry, I can have someone bring you something to eat."
I turned. "I'm fine," I said automatically. In truth, I was starving, but I knew I'd feel disadvantaged grubbing down food in this man's presence. "Kinsey Milhone," I said as I held out my hand. "Thanks for seeing me tonight."
"Joseph Ayers," he replied.
He was probably in his late 40s, with the intense air of a gynecologist delivering embarrassing news. He wore glasses with large lenses and heavy tortoiseshell frames. He tended to keep his head down, dark eyes peering up somberly. His handshake was firm, and his flesh felt as slick as if he'd just donned rubber gloves. His forehead was lined, his face elongated, an effect exaggerated by the creases beside his mouth and down the length of his cheeks. His dark hair was beginning to thin on top, but I could see that he'd been vigorously handsome once upon a time. He wore the requisite tuxedo. If he was still exhausted from long hours in the air, he showed no signs of it. He gestured me onto one of the leather chairs, and I took a seat. He sat down behind the desk and placed a finger against his lips, tapping thoughtfully while he studied me.
"Actually, you might look good on camera. You have an interesting face."
"No offense, Mr. Ayers, but I've seen one of your films. Faces are the least of it." He smiled slightly.
"You'd be surprised. There was a time when the audience wanted big, voluptuous women, Marilyn Monroe types, almost grotesquely well-endowed. Now we're looking for something a little more realistic. Not that I'm trying to talk you into anything."
"This is good," I said.
"I have a film school background," he said, as if I'd pressed for an explanation. "Like George Lucas and Oliver Stone, those guys. Not that I put myself in the same league with them. I'm an academic at heart. That's the point I was trying to make."
"Do they know what you do?" He cocked his head toward the window.
"I've always said I was in the business, which is true. At least it was. I sold my company a year ago to an international conglomerate. That's what I've been doing in Europe these past few weeks, tying up loose ends.
You must have been quite successful.
More so than the average Hollywood producer. My overhead was low, and I never had to tolerate union bosses or studio heads. If I wanted to do a project, I did it, just like that.
He snapped his fingers to illustrate.
Every film I've done has been an instant hit, which is more than most Hollywood producers can say.
What about Lorna? How'd you meet her?
I was down in Santa Teresa Memorial Day weekend. This would have been a couple of years ago. I spotted her in a hotel bar and asked if she was interested in an acting career. She laughed in my face. I gave her my card and a couple of my video cassettes. She called me some months later and expressed an interest. I set up the shoot. She flew up to San Francisco and did 2.5 days' work, for which she was paid $2,500. That's the extent of it.
I'm still puzzled by the fact that the film never went into distribution.
Let's just say I wasn't happy with the finished product. The film looked cheap and the camera work was lousy. The company that bought me out ended up taking my entire library, but that one wasn't included in the deal.
Did you know Lorna was working as a hooker on the side?
No, but it doesn't surprise me. Do you know what they call those people? Sex workers. A sex worker might do all manner of things. Massage, exotic dance, outcall, lesbian videos, hardcore magazines. They're like migrant pickers on the circuit. They go where the work is, sometimes city to city. Not that I'm saying she'd done related work. I'm filling you in on the big picture.
I watched his face, marveling at the matter-of-fact tone he was using.
What about you? What was your relationship with her? I was in London when she was killed. I left on the 20th.
I disregarded the non sequitur, though it interested me. When we talked on the phone, he'd been vague about how long ago her death had occurred. Maybe he'd done an internal audit in anticipation of my arrival. He opened a drawer and took out a slip of paper.
I checked the payroll roster for the film she did. These are the names and addresses of a couple of crew members I've been in touch with since. I can't guarantee they're still here in San Francisco, but it's a place to start.
I took the slip and glanced at it, recognizing the names from the list I'd checked. Both San Francisco numbers were now disconnects.
Thanks. I appreciate this.
Worthless as it is, I thought.
He got up from the desk. Now, if you'll forgive me, I have to put in a quick appearance before I go to bed. Are you sure you wouldn't like a drink?
Thanks, but I'd better not. I have ground to cover yet, and I'm not in town that long.
I'll walk you out, he said courteously.
I followed him down the wide white marble stairs, across the foyer, and through a vast empty room with a domed ceiling and pale glossy hardwood floors. At the far end there was a small stage.
What will you do now that your business is sold? This is the ballroom, he said, catching the curiosity in my look. My wife had it refurbished. She gives charity balls for diseases only rich people get. To answer your question, I won't have to do anything.
Lucky you.
Not luck. This was my intention from the onset. I'm a goal-oriented person. I'd advise you to do likewise.
Absolutely, I said. In the foyer, we shook hands. I noticed he had the door closed before I reached the front walk. I retrieved my car, tipping the parking valet a buck. From his look of amazement, everybody else must have tipped him 5. I consulted my map. Russell Turpin's Haight Street address wasn't far. I headed south on Masonic and crossed the panhandle section of Golden Gate Park. Haight was 2 blocks up, and the address I needed was only 4 blocks down. The sidewalks were crowded with pedestrians. Remnants of the past glories of Haight-Ashbury were still in evidence. Vintage dress shops and bookstores, funky-looking restaurants, a storefront clinic. The street was well lighted, and there was still quite a bit of traffic. The street people were decked out like the flower children of old, still wearing bell-bottoms, nose rings, dreadlocks, torn blue jeans, leather, face paints, multiple earrings, backpacks, and knee-high boots. Music tumbled out of bars. In half the doorways, kids loitered, looking stoned, though perhaps on drugs more exotic than grass or lewds. I circled, driving an 8-block track, 2 down, 2 over, 2 up, 2 back,
trying to find a place to tuck my car. San Francisco seems ill-equipped to accommodate the number of vehicles within the city limits. Parked cars are squeezed into every available linear inch of curb, angled into hillsides, lined up on sidewalks, wedged against the buildings. Front bumpers are nosed in too close to fire hydrants. Back bumpers hang out into red-painted zones. Garage space is at a premium, and every driveway bristles with signs warding off the poachers. By the time I found parking, it was nearly 1 a.m. I tucked my rental around the corner on Baker Street, whipping into a place as another vehicle pulled out. I fumbled in the bottom of my handbag until I found my penlight. I locked my car and hiked up the hill the half-block to Haight. All of the buildings were close-packed, pastel, 4 and 5 stories tall. An occasional frail tree contributed a grace note of green. Many of the oversized windows were still lighted. From the street I could see, in a diminishing series of acute angles, fireplace mantels, bold abstract paintings, white walls, bookshelves, hanging plants, and crown molding. The address I had turned out to be a modern fourplex of shaggy brown shingles sandwiched between 2 Victorian frame houses. The street light was burned out, and I was left to surmise that one was painted dull red, the other an indigo blue with, perhaps, white trim. In the dark, both appeared to be shades of muddy gray. I talked to a painter once who worked on movie sets. For a film shot in black and white, he said the crew used brown paint in 11 different shades. My current surroundings had the same feel, an environment drained of color, reduced to tones of chestnut and dun. The gradations were infinite, but visible only to night souls. Turpin apparently occupied a second-floor apartment, and I was gratified to note that the hand-lettered card tucked in the slot actually specified Russell by name, along with a housemate named Sherry Stanislaus. I peered through the glass door at a handsomely papered foyer, with an apartment door on either side. At the rear, a stairway angled left and out of sight, probably doubling back on itself to an identical hallway above. I moved out to the street and looked up at the second-floor windows. The front rooms on both sides of the building were lighted, which suggested that the occupants were still awake. As I moved up the stairs to the entrance, I could hear the tapping of high heels approaching from behind me. I paused, looking back. The blonde coming up the stairs wore makeup so pale the effect was ghostly. Her eyes were elaborately done up with thick false eyelashes, 2 shades of eyeshadow, and a black pencil line on both her upper and lower lids. Her forehead was high, and her hair was teased upward at the crown, held back with a gaudy rhinestone clip. The rest of her hair was long and straight, splitting at the shoulder so that half extended down her back. A cluster of long curls tumbled over her breasts. Her long dangle earrings were shaped like elongated question marks. She wore a dark leotard on top and a slinky black skirt that was split up one side. Her hips were narrow, her stomach flat. She took out a ring of keys and gave me a long, cool look as she unlocked the foyer door.
"Looking for someone?"
"Russell Turpin."
"Well, you've come to the right place."
Her smile was self-contained, not unfriendly, but less than warm, I thought.
"He's not here, but you can come up and wait if you want. I'm his roommate."
"Thanks. You're Sherry?"
"That's right. Who are you, pray tell?"
"Kinsey Milhone," I said. "I left a message on your machine."
"I remember that. You're Lorna's friend," she said.
She pushed the door open, and I followed her in. She paused, making sure the door had latched shut again before she headed up the stairs. I trailed behind. Having lied on the phone, I now had to decide whether to play this straight. "Actually, Lorna and I never met," I said. "I'm a private investigator looking into her death." "You knew she'd been killed?"
"Yes, of course we did.
I'm happy to hear you mention it. Russell wasn't looking forward to delivering the bad news about Lorna's death." Her stockings were black mesh, and her 3-inch stiletto heels forced her calves into high relief. When we reached the second-floor landing, she unlocked the door to apartment C. She stepped out of her shoes with a little grimace of relief, then padded through the living room in her stocking feet. I thought she'd turn on a table lamp, but apparently she preferred the gloom.
"Make yourself comfortable," she said.
"You have any idea what time he'll be home?" Any time, I'd imagine. He doesn't like staying out too late. She turned on a light in the kitchen, which was visible through bifold shutters resting on the countertop. She pushed the shutters open. Through the gap, I watched her take out two ice cube trays, which she cracked and emptied into an acrylic ice bucket.
I'm having a drink. If you want one, speak up. I hate playing hostess, but I'm good for one round. I have a bottle of Chardonnay open, if you're interested. You look like a white wine kind of girl.
I'd love some. You need help?
Don't we all, she remarked.
You have offices in the city?
I'm from Santa Teresa.
She tilted her head, peering through the pass-through at me.
Why would you come all the way up to see Russell? He's not a suspect, I hope.
Are you his girlfriend? I thought it was time I posed the questions instead of her.
I wouldn't say that. We're fond of each other, but we're not exactly an item. He prefers to be thought of as footloose and fancy-free. One of those types.
She plunked several ice cubes in a tall glass and splashed scotch halfway up the side. She squirted in seltzer water, using one of those devices I'd seen in old 30s movies. She took a sip, shuddered slightly, and then set the glass aside while she found a wine glass in the cupboard. She held it up to the light and decided it wasn't clean enough. She rinsed and dried it. She took the Chardonnay out of the refrigerator and filled my glass, then put the bottle in a cooler and left it on the counter. I moved over to the pass-through and took the wine glass she handed me.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but Russell's very screwed up, she said.
Really? I've never met him.
You can take my word for it. You want to know why? Because he's hung like a mule.
I said, ah. Having seen him in action, I could attest to that. Sherry smiled.
I like the ah. It's diplomatic. Come on back to my room and we can talk while I change. If I don't get out of this girdle, I'm going to kill myself very soon.
Chapter 11. Sherry's bedroom furniture consisted of a 50s suite of blonde wood with curving lines. She sat down at a dressing table with a big round mirror in the center and two deep drawers on either side. She turned on a dressing table lamp, leaving the rest of the room shrouded in shadows. She had twin beds with blonde wood headboards, a blonde bed table, an old 45 record player with a fat black spindle, and a black canvas and wrought iron butterfly chair covered with discarded clothing. My only choice for seating was one of the twin beds. I elected to lean against the doorframe instead. Sherry wiggled out of her girdle and pantyhose and tossed them on the floor, then turned to study herself in the mirror. She leaned forward, checking the lines near her eyes with a critical gaze. She shook her head in disgust.
"Isn't aging the pits? Sometimes I think I should just shoot myself and get it over with."
While I watched, she spread out a clean white towel and took out cold cream, a skin toner, cotton balls, and Q-tips, apparently in preparation for removing her makeup. I've seen dental hygienists who weren't as meticulous in assembling their instruments. "Did you know Lorna?" I asked.
"I met her. I didn't know her."
"What did you think of her?"
"I was envious, of course. She was what they call a natural beauty. All so effortless. It's enough to make you sick." Her eyes met mine in the mirror. "You don't wear a lot of makeup, so you probably can't relate to this. But I spend hours on myself, and to what end? 15 minutes on the street, and it all evaporates. My lipstick's eaten off. My eyeshadow ends up in this crease. Look at this. My eyeliner gets transferred to my upper lid. Every time I blow my nose, my foundation comes off on the tissue like paint. Lorna was just the opposite. She never had to do anything at all."
She peeled off a false eyelash and placed it in a small box where it lay like a wink. She peeled off the other lash and placed it beside the first. Now it looked like two eyes closed in sleep.
"What I wouldn't have given to have skin like hers," she said. "Oh, well, what's a poor girl to do?"
She put a hand to her forehead and lifted off her hair. Under the wig, she wore what looked like a rubber bathing cap. She dropped her voice to its natural baritone, addressing my reflection.
"Well, here's Russell now. Nice to meet you," he said.
Like a disappearing act, Sherry vanished, leaving a slightly gawky-looking man in her place. He turned and struck a pose.
"Be honest. Which do you prefer?"
I smiled.
I like sherry.
So do I, he said. He turned and looked at himself again, squinting closely.
I can't tell you how obnoxious it is waking up every morning to a beard. And a penis? My God! Picture that in your lacy little underpants. Like a big old ugly worm. Scares me to death.
He began to put cold cream on his face, wiping off foundation in swipes. I couldn't take my eyes off him. The illusion had been perfect. Do you do this every day? Dress up in women's clothes?
Most days. After work, from 9 to 5, I'm Russell. Tie, sport coat, button-down collar, the whole bit. I don't wear wingtips, but the moral and spiritual equivalent.
What sort of work do you do?
I'm the assistant manager at the local Circuit City, selling stereo systems. Nights, I can relax and do anything I want.
You don't make a living from the acting?
Oh, you saw the film, he said. I hardly made a dime, and it never went anywhere, which I must say was a relief. Think of the irony of getting famous as Russell when I'm really Sherry at heart.
I just talked to Joe Ayers at his place. He says he sold his company.
Trying to turn respectable, I'd imagine.
He raised his eyebrows, smiling slightly. His expression suggested there was no real chance of that. Foundation gone, he took a cotton ball and soaked it with skin toner. He began to wipe off the cold cream and any remaining traces of makeup. How many films did you make for him?
Just the one.
Were you disappointed it was never released?
I was at the time. I've realized since then that I don't care to capitalize on my equipment. I despise being male. I really hate all the macho posturing and bullshit, all the effort it takes. It's much more fun being female. Sometimes I'm tempted to do away with it, but I can't bear to have myself surgically altered, as endowed as I am. Maybe an organ donor program would be interested, he said. He waved a hand airily. But enough of my tacky problems. What else can I tell you about Lorna?
I'm not sure. I gather you really didn't know her that well.
That depends on your frame of reference. We spent 2 days together while the film was being shot. We had an instant rapport and laughed our tiny asses off. She was such a kick. Kinky and fearless with a wicked sense of humor. We were soul sisters. I mean that. I was heartbroken when I heard that she had died, of all things.
That was the only time you saw her, during the filming?
No, I ran into her maybe 2 months later, up here shopping with that piggy-looking sister.
Which one? She has two.
Oh, really? I can't remember the name. Something odd, as I recall. She looked like an imitation Lorna, same face, but all porked out. Anyway, I saw them on the street down around Union Square, and we stopped to chat about nothing in particular. She looked spectacular as ever. That's the last I saw of her.
What about the other actress, Nancy Dobbs? Was she a friend of Lorna's?
Oh, God! Wasn't she the worst? Talk about wooden. She was pretty bad, I admitted.
Has she done other films for Ayers?
I doubt it. In fact, I'm sure not. I think she just did that one as a lark. Someone else had been hired and opted out at the last minute. Lorna had her pegged. Nancy was terribly ambitious, without the talent or the body to get very far. She's one of those women who'd try to screw her way to the top, only no one would have her, so how far could she get? What a dog, Russell laughed. Actually, she'd have screwed a dog if she'd thought it would help.
How'd she get along with Lorna?
As far as I know, they never had any kind of snit, but privately each felt infinitely superior to the other. I know because they both took to confiding in me between takes.
Is she still in the city? I'd like to talk to her. Russell looked at me with surprise.
You didn't see her tonight? I thought you must have talked to her at Ayers' little soiree.
What would she be doing there?
She's married to him. That's the point, isn't it? All during the shoot, she really flung herself at him. Next thing we heard, voila, she was Mrs. Joseph Ayers, noted socialite. It's probably why he dumped the porno flick. Imagine that getting out. He calls her Duchess, by the way. Isn't that pretentious?
Was there ever a suggestion that Joe Ayers' relationship with Lorna was other than professional?
He was never involved with her sexually, if that's what you mean.
It's really a bit of a cliché to imagine these guys are out sampling the merchandise. Believe me, his only interest was in making a buck.
Lorna's mother seems to think her death was related to the film somehow.
Possible, I suppose. But why would anybody kill her for that? She might have been a star if she'd lived. As for those of us who worked on it, trust me, we got along. We were all so grateful for the opportunity, we made a point of it, he said.
How in the world did her mother find out?
Somebody sent her the tape. Russell stared at my reflection in the mirror.
As an expression of condolences, that's in poor taste, he said. You'd have to wonder at the motive.
Ain't that the truth? I went back to the motel, feeling wide awake. By 2 in the morning, Santa Teresa has shut down. In San Francisco, all the bars had closed, but numerous businesses were still open. Gas stations, bookstores, fitness gyms, video rentals, coffee shops, even clothing stores. I changed out of my flats and the all-purpose dress, stripping off my pantyhose with the same relief Sherry had expressed. Once in my jeans and turtleneck, I felt like I was back in my own skin again. I found an all-night diner 2 doors away from the Del Rey and ate a lavish breakfast. I returned to my room and put the chain on the track. I plunked off my Reeboks, propped all the pillows at my back, and checked Lorna's file again, leafing through the crime scene sketches and the accompanying pictures. The photographer had shot the outside of the house, front yard and back, with views looking north, south, east, and west. There were shots of both the front and back porches, wood railings, windows. The front door had been closed, but unlocked, with no signs of forced entry. Within the cabin itself, there was no weapon visible and no evidence of a struggle. I could see colored smudges where the fingerprint technicians had been at work with their various powders. According to the report, elimination fingerprints and palm prints had been taken, and most latents on the premises had been accounted for. Many were Lorna's. Some were from family members, the landlord, her friend Danielle, a couple of acquaintances who'd been interviewed by homicide investigators. Many surfaces had been wiped clean. The photographs of Lorna began in long shot, establishing her position relative to the front door. There were intermediate-range photos, close-ups with a 6-inch ruler in evidence to indicate scale. The log showed an orderly progression through the area. I was frustrated by the flat, two-dimensional images. I wanted to crawl into the frame, examine all the items on the tabletops, open up the drawers, and pick through the contents. I found myself squinting, moving pictures closer to my face and then back again, as if the subject matter might suddenly leap into sharper focus. I would stare at the body, scanning the background, taking in items through my peripheral vision. The cabin, when I'd seen it, had been stripped of all the furniture. Only the bare bones of Lorna's living space were left intact, empty cabinets and bathroom, plumbing and electrical fixtures. It was good to see the pictures to correct my mental process. In memory, I had already begun to distort the room sizes and relative distances. I went through all the pictures a second time, and then a third. In the 10 months since Lorna's death, the crime scene had been dismantled, and this was all that remained. If murder were ever proved and a suspect charged, the entire case could easily rest on the contents of this envelope.
And what were the chances?
What could I possibly hope to accomplish this late in the game? Basically, in my investigation, I was mimicking the spiral method of a crime scene search, starting at the center, moving outward and around in ever-widening circles. The problem was that I had no direction and no hard line to take. I didn't even have a theory about why she had died. I felt as though I were fishing, fly-casting, in the hopes that I'd somehow snag myself a killer.
All that wily devil had to do was lie low, looking up at my lure from the bottom of the cove.
I sorted through the file while I let my mind wander. Aside from the random or the serial killer, the perpetrator of a homicide has to have a reason, some concrete motive for wanting the victim dead. In the case of Lorna Kepler, I was still uncertain what the reason was. Financial gain was a possibility. She'd had assets in her estate. I made a note to myself to check with Janice on that score. Given the assumption that Lorna had no living issue, Janice and Mace would be her legal heirs if she died intestate. It was hard to picture either one of them guilty of murder.
For one thing, if it were Janice, she'd have to be a fool to turn around and bring me into it. Mace was a question mark. He certainly hadn't conformed to my notion of a grieving parent. Her sisters were another possibility, though neither struck me as sufficiently smart or sufficiently energetic. I picked up the phone and dialed Frankie's coffee shop. This time Janice answered. I could hear jukebox music in the background, but not much else. "Hi, Janice. This is Kinsey up in San Francisco." "Well, Kinsey, how are you? I'm always surprised to hear from you at such an hour. Did you find the fellow she was working for?" "I talked to him this evening, and I also tracked down one of the other actors in the film. I haven't made up my mind about either one of them. In the meantime, something else has come up. I'm wondering if I could take a look at Lorna's financial records."
"I suppose so. Can you say why, or is that classified?"
"Nothing's classified between us. You're paying for my services. I'm trying to pin down a motive. Money's an obvious possibility."
"I guess that's true, but it's hard to see how it could apply in this case. None of us had any idea she had money until after she died and we went through her files. I'm still in shock. It was unbelievable, given my perception. I was forever slipping her a 20 just to make sure she'd eat right. And there she was with all those stocks and bonds and savings accounts. She must have had 6. You'd think with that kind of money she'd have lived a little better."
I wanted to tell her the money was part of Lorna's pension fund, but it seemed unkind somehow, since she hadn't lived long enough to use it.
"Did she have a will?"
"Well, yes. Just one sheet of paper that she'd written out herself. She left everything to Mace and me."
"I'd like to see that, if you don't object."
"You can see anything you want. When I get home from work, I'll find the box of Lorna's personal effects and leave it on Berlin's desk. You can stop by when you get back and pick it up from her."
"I'd appreciate that. I want to talk to the two of them in any event."
"Oh, shoot. And that reminds me, have you talked to that woman Lorna used to house-sit for?"
"Once."
"Well, I wonder if you'd do me a favor. Last time I went through Lorna's things, I came across a set of house keys I'm sure belonged to her. I've been trying to return them and haven't had a minute to take care of it."
"You want me to drop them off?"
"If you would. I feel like I should do it myself, but I just don't have time. And I'd appreciate it if you'd make sure I get everything back when you finish going through it. There's some dividend and interest statements I'm going to need to pass along to the probate attorney when he files her income taxes."
"Has the estate been settled yet?"
"It's still in the works. What I'm giving you is copies, but I'd still like to have them back."
"No problem. I can probably drop it all off to you day after tomorrow."
"That'd be fine." I could hear the swell of chatter in the background. She said, "Uh-oh, I gotta go."
"See you tomorrow," I said, and hung up.
I looked around at the room, which was serviceable but glum. The mattress was as dense as mud, while the pillows were foam rubber and threatened serious neck damage. I'd made reservations for a noon flight out of San Francisco. It was now almost 3 a.m. I wasn't ready to sleep. If I junked my return ticket, I could drive the rental car back and drop it at the airport in Santa Teresa, where my VW was sitting in the long-term parking lot. The trip would take roughly 6 hours, and if I could manage to avoid dozing off at the wheel, I'd be back around 9. I suddenly found myself energized by the notion of heading home. I swung my feet over the side of the bed, found my Reeboks, pulled them on, and left the laces dangling. I went into the bathroom, gathered up my toiletries, and shoved everything in the duffel. It took me longer to wake the night manager than it took me to check out. By 3:22, I was heading south on the 101. There's nothing as hypnotic as a highway at night. Visual stimulation is reduced to the lines on the road, asphalt zipping past in a series of streaks. Any shrubbery at the side of the road is diminished to a blur. All the trailer trucks were in transit, semis carrying goods that ranged from new cars to furniture, from flammable liquids to flattened cardboard boxes. Off to the side, I caught sight of townlet after townlet encased in darkness, illuminated only by rows of street lamps. An occasional billboard provided visual distraction. At long intervals, a truck stop appeared, like an island of light. I had to stop twice for coffee. Having opted to head back, I now found the drive narcotic and was struggling to stay awake. The radio in the rental car was good company. I flipped from station to station, listening to a talk show host, classical and country music, and countless newscasts. Once upon a time I'd smoked cigarettes, and I could still remember the habit as a way of marking time on car trips. Now I'd rather drive off a bridge than light up. Another hour passed. It was nearly dawn, and the sky was turning white, the trees along the road beginning to reclaim their color, now charcoal green and dark chartreuse. Dimly I was aware of the sun coming up like a beach ball into my line of vision, the colors of the sky shading up from dark gray to mauve to peach to bright yellow. I had to flip down the visor to keep the glare out of my eyes. By 9:14 I'd turned in the rental and picked up my VW, and I was pulling into a parking place in front of my apartment. My eyes felt itchy, and I ached from a weariness that felt like the flu. But at least I was home. I let myself in, checked to see that there were no messages, brushed my teeth, took my shoes off, and fell into bed. For once, sleep descended like a blow to the head, and I went down, down, down. I woke at 5 p.m. The 8 hours should have been adequate, but as starved as I was for sleep, I felt I was dragging myself out of quicksand. I was still struggling to adjust to the inverted pattern my life had taken. In bed at dawn, up again in the afternoon. I was eating breakfast at lunchtime, dinner in the dead of night, though often that meal turned out to be cold cereal or scrambled eggs and toast, which meant I ate breakfast twice. I was vaguely aware of a psychological shift, a change in my perception now that I'd substituted night for day. Like a form of jet lag, my internal clock was no longer synchronized with the rest of the world's. My usual sense of myself was breaking down, and I wondered if a hidden personality might suddenly emerge as if wakened from a long sleep. My day life was calling, and I was curiously reluctant to answer. I rolled out of bed, dumped my dirty clothes, took a shower, and got dressed.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
I rolled out of bed, dumped my dirty clothes, took a shower, and got dressed. I stopped at a mini-mart where I grabbed a carton of yogurt and an apple, eating in my car as I headed over to the Keplers. I could have used a couple more hours of sleep, but I was hoping to talk to Lorna's sisters before their mother woke up. Like me, her days and nights were turned around, and I felt a strange bond with her. Mace's plumbing truck wasn't parked in the drive this time. I left my VW on the berm, by the white split-rail fence, and moved up the walk to the porch, where I knocked. Trini answered the door, though it took her a while.
"Oh, hi. Mom worked a double shift, and she's not up yet."
I figured as much. She said she'd tuck some information in a box and leave it with Berlin.
"She's not here right now. She's running some errands. You want to come in and wait?"
"Thanks." I followed her through the small, densely furnished living room to the dining area, which was located at one end of the kitchen. Sunset wasn't far off, and the kitchen windows were getting dark, lending the lighted kitchen an artificial air of warmth. An ironing board had been set up, and the scent of freshly pressed cotton made me long for summer. "Mind if I take a look at Berlin's desk? If the box is close to the surface, I can go ahead and get it." Trini took up the iron again.
"It's right in there."
She pointed toward the door that led into the den. One corner of the room apparently doubled as the offices for Kepler Plumbing. I remembered seeing both the desk and the filing cabinet the night I talked to Mace. A banker's box with my name scrawled on top was sitting right in plain sight. For once, I resisted any further urge to snoop. I lifted the lid to check the contents. A fragrance wafted up, some delicate combination of citrus and spice. I closed my eyes, wondering if this was Lorna's scent. I'd experienced it before, the very air saturated with someone's characteristic smell. With men, it's aftershave, leather or sweat. With women, it's cologne. The house keys Janice had mentioned were sitting on top of a neatly packed collection of file folders, all in alphabetical order. Bank statements, past income taxes, dividends, stocks, assorted annual reports. Tucked into one end of the box was a folded cashmere scarf. I pressed the length of it against my face, smelling cut grass, cinnamon, lemon, and clove. I hauled the box back to the kitchen and set it by one of the kitchen chairs, the scarf laid on top.
"Is this Lorna's? It was in the box with her stuff."
Trini shrugged.
I guess.
I folded it twice and tucked it back where it had been. Mind if I sit down? I was hoping I'd have a chance to talk to you.
Fine, she said.
She slid the lever on the iron to the off position. I hope I'm not interrupting dinner preparations.
I got a casserole in the oven. All I have to do is heat it and make a salad real quick.
I took a seat, wondering how to coax some information out of her. I wasn't even sure what I wanted to know, but I considered it a bonus to be alone with her. She was wearing the same cutoffs I'd seen her in before. Her legs looked solid, her bare feet tucked into rubber flip-flops. Her T-shirt this time must have been an XXL, the front emblazoned with a painted design. She moved from the ironing board to the kitchen table, where she sat down across from me and began squeezing a tube of paint in a Jackson Pollock-type design on the front of a new T-shirt. Dots and squiggles. Hanging from a knob on one of the kitchen cabinets was a completed work, its lines of paint puffed out in three dimensions. She caught my gaze.
"This is puff paint," she said. "You put it on and let it dry, and when you iron it on the wrong side, it puffs out like that."
"That's cute," I said. I got up and moved closer to the kitchen cabinet, taking a moment to inspect the finished product. Looked dreadful to me, but what do I know? "You sell these?"
"Well, not yet, but I'm hoping. I made this one I got on, and whenever I go out, everybody's like, 'Oh, wow, cool T-shirt.' So I thought since I wasn't working, I could set up my own business."
My, oh my. She and her sister Lorna, both driven by the entrepreneurial spirit. "How long have you been doing this?"
"Just today."
I took my seat at the kitchen table again, watching Trini work. I began to cast out my line. Surely there was something I could wheedle out of her. To my right was a stack of travel brochures, touting Alaskan cruises, ski holidays, and package tours to Canada and the Caribbean. I picked up a pamphlet and began to scan the copy. "The World's Last Unspoiled Paradise. Stunning white beaches. Deep azure lagoons." Trini saw what I was doing.
"Those are Berlin's."
"Where's she going?"
"She doesn't know yet. She says Alaska looks good."
"Are you going too?"
She made a disappointed face. "I don't have the money."
"Too bad. It looks like fun," I said. "She doesn't mind traveling alone?"
"Nuh-uh. She likes it. Not all the time, but if she has to, she says. She did the one trip already in the fall."
"Really? Where'd she go then?"
"Acapulco. She loved it. She says she'll take me if she goes back."
"That's neat. I was in Viento Negro last summer, but that's as far south as I've been."
"I haven't even been that far. Berlin's always liked to travel. I don't have the same bug. I mean, I like it and all, but there's stuff I'd rather do."
"Like what?"
"I don't know. Buy clothes and stuff."
I tried another tack. "Lorna's death must have been hard. Are you doing okay with that?"
"I guess so. It's been hard on them. I mean, Mom and Daddy used to be a lot closer. Once Lorna died, seems like everything changed. And now it's like Mom's the only one caught up in it. Lorna's all she talks about. Berlin gets her feelings hurt. It really pisses her off. It's like, what about us? Don't we count for anything?"
"Were you close to Lorna?"
"Not really. Lorna wasn't close to anyone. She lived in her world, and we lived in ours. She had that cabin, and she liked it private. She hated it if people stopped by without asking. A lot of times she wasn't even home. Nights especially, she'd be out somewhere. She made it plain you should keep away unless you called first and got yourself invited."
"How often did you see her?"
"A lot over here, whenever she stopped by. But at the cabin, maybe once or twice in the 3 years she lived there. Berlin liked to go over. She's kind of nosy by nature."
"Lorna was real mysterious."
"Like what?" "I don't know. Like, why was she so picky about people dropping in? What's the big deal? She didn't have to worry about us. We're her sisters."
"Did you ever find out where she went at night?"
"Nuh-uh.
Probably wasn't any place special. After a while, I more or less accepted her for what she was. She wasn't sociable like us. Berlin and me are buddies. We like to pal around and double date and stuff like that. Right now, like, neither of us has a boyfriend, so we see movies and go out dancing on the weekends. Lorna never did the first nice thing for either one of us. Well, she did now and then, but you practically had to lay down and beg.
How'd you find out about her death?
The police stopped by the house and asked to speak to Daddy. He was the one who told Mom, and she told us. It was kind of creepy. I mean, we thought Lorna was out of town. Off on vacation is what Mom said. So we didn't think anything about it when we didn't hear from her. We just figured she'd give us a call when she got back. It's horrible to think she was just laying there, moldering.
It must have been awful.
Oh, God. I started screaming, and Burl got white as a ghost. Daddy was, like, in shock. Mother took it the worst. She still isn't over it. She was staggering around, shrieking and crying, practically tearing her hair out. I've never seen her like that. She's usually the one holds the rest of us together. Like when Grandma died? This was her own mother. She kept real calm, made airline reservations, packed our bags so we could go back to Iowa to the funeral. We were all young kids, acting dumb, boo-hooing, real pitiful. She got everything all organized, as cool as you please. When we found out about Lorna, she just fell to pieces.
Most parents don't expect to outlive their kids, I said.
That's what everybody says. It doesn't help that the police think she was murdered and all.
What's your opinion?
Trini made a mute shrug with her mouth. I guess she could have died from her allergies. I don't like to think about it. Too icky for my taste.
I shifted the subject. Were you the one who went to San Francisco with Lorna last year?
That was Berlin, she said. Who told you about that?
I met the guy on the tape.
She glanced up from her work with interest.
Which one?
Chapter 12. She had the good grace to blush. Despite the dark brown hair, she was fair-complected, and the tint hit her cheeks like a heat rash. She dropped her gaze to the work in front of her, suddenly much busier than she'd been before. I could tell she was casting about for a way to change the subject. She bent over her work. I guess it was important to get the paint dots just right.
Trini?
What?
How'd you happen to see the tape? And don't say which tape, because you know exactly which tape I'm talking about.
I didn't see the tape.
Oh, come on, of course you did. If you didn't, how'd you know there was more than one guy?
I don't even know what you're talking about, she said with pious irritation.
I'm talking about the porno tape in which Lorna appeared. Remember? Your mother told you.
Maybe Mom told us that, too, about the other guy, more than one.
I said, uh-huh, in my most skeptical tone. What happened? Did Lorna give you a copy?
No, she said, giving it two sliding syllables, high note to low, offended by the notion.
Then how'd you know there was more than one man?
I guessed. What do you care?
I stared at her. The obvious conclusion leapt to mind. Were you the one who wrapped it and put it out in the mailbox?
No, and anyway, I don't have to answer.
This time the tone was sullen, but the blush came up again. This was better than a polygraph. Who did?
I don't know anything about anything, so you might as well change the subject. This is not a court of law, you know. I'm not under oath.
An attorney in the making.
For a moment I thought she'd put her fingers in her ears and start humming just to shut me out.
I cocked my head, trying to catch her eye. Trini, I sang. She was studiously engaged in the T-shirt in front of her, adding a gaudy orange spiral of puff paint. I said, come on. I don't care what you did, and I swear I will never say a word to your parents. I've been wondering who sent the tape to them, and now I know. In a way, you did us all a favor. If your mother hadn't been upset about it, she wouldn't have come to me, and the whole investigation might have died where it was. I waited and then gave her a line prompt. Was it Berlin's idea or yours?
I don't have to answer.
How about a nod if I guess right?
Trini added some lime green stars to the T-shirt. It was getting tackier by the minute, but I felt as though we were getting someplace.
I'll bet it was Berlin.
Silence. Am I right?
Trini lifted one shoulder, still without making eye contact.
Ah,
I'm assuming that little gesture means yes. So Berlin sent the tape. Now the question is, how'd she get it? More silence. Come on, Trini. Please, please, please? I learned this interrogation method back in grade school, and it's particularly effective when the subject matter is a cross-your-heart type secret just between us girls. I could see her softening. Whatever our confidences, we're usually dying to tell, especially if the confession involves the condemnation of someone else. Her tongue moved across her teeth as though she were testing for fuzz. Finally, she said, "Swear you won't tell." I held up my hand as if taking an oath. "I won't say a word to another soul. I won't even mention that you mentioned it." We just got sick of hearing how wonderful she was, because she wasn't all that great. She was pretty, and she had a great bod, but big deal, you know?
Really, I said.
Plus, she took money for sex. I mean, Berlin or me would never have done that. So how come Lorna got elevated to the stars? She wasn't pure. She wasn't even good.
Human nature, I guess. Your mother doesn't get to have Lorna in her life, but she keeps that perfect picture in her heart, I said. It's hard to let go when that's all you have.
Her voice had begun to rise. But Lorna was a bitch. All she thought about was herself. She hardly gave Mom and Daddy the time of day. I'm the one helps out, for all the good it does. I'm as sweet as I know how, and it doesn't make any difference. Lorna's the one Mom loves. Berlin and me are just bullshit. Emotion was causing her skin to change colors, chameleon-like. Tears rose like water, suddenly coming to the boil. She put a hand to her face, which twisted as a sob broke through. I reached out and touched her hand.
Trini, that's just not true. Your mother loves you very much. The night she came to my office, she talked about you in Berlin, all the fun you have, all the help around the house. You're a treasure to her, honestly.
She was crying by then, her voice high-pitched and pinched.
Then why doesn't she tell us? She never says a word.
Maybe she's afraid to. Or maybe she doesn't know how anymore. But that doesn't mean she isn't crazy about you.
I can't stand it. I can't.
She sobbed like a child, giving rein to her grief. I sat and let her work it through on her own. Finally, the tears subsided, and she sighed heavily. She fumbled in the pocket of her cutoffs, pulling out a ratty hanky, which she pressed against her eyes.
Oh, God,
she said. She propped her elbows on the table and then blew her nose. She looked down, realizing she'd picked up the imprint of wet paint on her forearm.
Well, shit, look at that, she said.
A bubble of laughter came up like a burp escaping.
What's going on?
Berlin was standing at the front door, her expression blank with suspicion. Both of us jumped, and Trini let out a gasp.
Burl, you scared me half to death, she said. Where did you come from?
She wiped her eyes in haste, trying to cover up the fact that she'd been crying. Berlin had a plastic carry-all of groceries in one hand, her key ring in the other. She fixed Trini with a look.
Pardon me for sneaking. I didn't know I was interrupting. I parked in the driveway, big as life.
Her gaze jumped to mine.
What's the matter with you?
Nothing, I said. We were talking about Lorna, and Trini got upset.
Just what I need. I've heard enough about her. Daddy's got it right. Let's just drop the subject and get on to something else. Where's Mom? Is she up yet?
I think she's in the shower, Trini said.
Belatedly, I became aware of water running somewhere. Berlin dumped her purse on a chair and moved over to the counter, where she began to unload grocery items. Like Trini, she wore cutoffs, a T-shirt, and flip-flops, professional attire for the working plumber's helper. The roots on her blonde hair were showing through. Despite the 4-year age difference, her face was a projection of Lorna's in middle age. Maybe young death isn't bad. Perfect beauty suspended in the amber of time. Berlin turned to Trini.
Could you give me a hand? She said, aggrieved. How long has she been here?
Trini shot me a pleading look and went over to help her sister.
10 minutes, I supplied, though I hadn't been asked. I just stopped by for the stuff your mother left. Trini was showing me how to make T-shirts, and then we got talking about Lorna's death.
I reached for the box, thinking to flee the premises before Janice emerged. Berlin studied me with interest.
"So you said." "Ah, well, fun as this is, I'd better be on my way."
I got up, slung the strap of my handbag over my shoulder, and picked up the box, ignoring Berlin.
"Thanks for the painting lesson," I said to Trini. "I'm sorry about Lorna. I know you loved her."
Her smile was pained. She said, "Bye," and gave me a half-hearted wave. Berlin went into the den without a backward look, closing the door behind her with a decided snap. I stuck my tongue out at her and crossed my eyes, which made Trini laugh. I mouthed, "Thank you," to Trini, and took my leave.
It was nearly 6 o'clock when I unlocked my office door and put the box of Lorna's files on my desk. Everybody else in the firm was gone. Even Lonnie, who usually works late, had packed it in for the day. All my tax forms and receipts were still sitting where I'd left them. I was disappointed the elves and fairies hadn't come along to finish up my work. I gathered all the bits and pieces and tucked them in a drawer, clearing space. I doubted Lorna's papers would yield any information, but I needed to take a look. I put some coffee on and sat down, set the lid of the box aside, and began to work my way through the manila folders. It looked as if someone had lifted Lorna's files directly from a desk drawer and placed them in the banker's box. Each file was labeled neatly. Tucked in the front were copies of various probate forms that Janice must have picked up from the attorney. It looked as though she were doing the preliminary work of culling and assembling, making penciled notes. I studied each sheet, trying to form a picture of Lorna Kepler's financial status. An accountant could probably have made quick work of this stuff. I, on the other hand, having made a C- in high school math, had to frown and sigh and chew my pencil. Janice had filled out a schedule of Lorna's assets, listing the cash in her possession at the time of her death, uncashed checks payable to her, bank accounts, stocks, bonds, treasury bills, mutual funds. Lorna had no pension plan and no life insurance. She did have a small insurance policy for the jewelry she'd acquired. She hadn't owned any real property, but her liquid assets came to a little under $500,000. Not bad for a part-time clerk harlot. Janice had included a copy of Lorna's will, which seemed clear enough. She'd left all her valuables, including jewelry, cash, stocks, bonds, and other financial assets, to her parents. Attached to the will was a copy of the completed proof of holographic instrument that Janice had filed. In it, she attested that she was acquainted with the decedent for 25 years, had personal knowledge of her handwriting, that she had examined the will and determined that its handwritten provisions were written by and the instrument signed by the hand of the decedent. Danielle had speculated that Lorna wouldn't have a will, but the document seemed consistent with Lorna's systematic nature. Neither Berlin nor Trini had been left any money, but that didn't seem unusual. $2,000 apiece might have gone a long way toward softening their attitudes, but she might not have understood the animosity they harbored. Or maybe she knew and felt the same about them. At any rate, the estate wasn't complicated. I didn't think it necessitated the services of an attorney, but the Keplers might have been intimidated by all the official paperwork. I checked back through the last few years of Lorna's income tax. Her only W-2s were from the water treatment plant. Under your occupation, she had listed herself as secretary and mental health consultant. I had to smile at that. She'd been meticulous in reporting income, taking only standard deductions. She'd never donated a dime to charity, but she'd been largely honest with the government. To the recipient, I suppose, the services of a prostitute might be classified under mental health. As for the payments themselves, I guess no one at the IRS had ever wondered why the bulk of her consulting fees were paid to her in cash. Janice had notified the post office to forward Lorna's mail to her, and she'd tossed in a stack of unopened statements, windowed envelopes from various sources, all of them marked Important Tax Information. I opened a few, just to check the year-end against my list. Among them was a statement from a bank in Simi Valley that I'd seen on her tax forms for the last 2 years. The account had been closed out, but the bank had sent her a 1099 INT, reporting the interest accrued during the first 4 months of the year.
I tucked that in with the other statements. All the credit cards had been canceled and notices sent to each company. I sorted through some of the files Lorne had kept. Canceled checks, receipts for utilities, various credit card slips. I laid out the canceled checks like a hand of solitaire. At the bottom, under Memo, she'd dutifully written in the purpose of the payment. Groceries, manicure, haircut, linen, sundries. There was something touching about the care she'd taken. She hadn't known she'd be dead by the time these checks came back. She hadn't known her last meal would be her last, that every action she'd taken and each endeavor she'd engaged in were part of some finite number that would soon run out. Sometimes the hardest part of my job is the incessant reminder of the fact we're all trying so assiduously to ignore. We are here temporarily. Life is only ours on loan. I put down my pencil and eased my feet up on the desk, rocking back on my swivel chair. The room seemed dark, and I reached over and flipped on the lamp on the bookshelf behind me. Among Lorna's possessions, there was no address book, no calendar, no appointment book of any kind. That might have sparked my curiosity, but I wondered if it didn't speak to Lorna's caution about her clients. Danielle had told me she was very tight-lipped, and I felt this discretion might extend to the keeping of written notes as well. I reached for the manila envelope that held the crime scene photographs. I sorted through until I found the angles that showed the papers on her table and countertop. I pulled the light over closer, but there was no way to see if there was an appointment book visible. I glanced at my watch. I was dog-tired. I was also bored and hungry, but I could feel my senses quicken as the darkness gathered depth. Maybe I was turning into a vampire or a werewolf, repelled by sunlight, seduced by the moon. I got up and shrugged into my jacket, leaving Lorna's papers on my desk. What was bothering me? I scanned the desktop. A fact, something obvious, had passed through my hands. The problem with being tired is that your brain doesn't work so hot. Idly, I paused and moved a batch of papers aside, leafing through the forms. I looked at the holographic will and Janice's supporting statement. I didn't think that was it. In theory, it would seem self-serving that Janice was in a position to attest to the legitimacy of a will from which she largely benefited. However, the truth of it was that if Lorna had died with no will at all, the result would have been the same. I picked up the bank notices and shuffled through them again, pausing when I got to the statement from the bank in Simi. The interest was minimal since she'd closed the account in April. Before that, she'd maintained a balance of roughly $20,000. I looked at the closing date. The zero balance showed as of Friday, April 20th, the day before she died. I pulled out the files Lieutenant Dolan had given me. The personal property inventory mentioned all manner of items found on the premises, including Lorna's handbag and her wallet, containing all her credit cards and $100 in cash. Nowhere was there mention of $20,000. I took the notice with me to the Xerox room around the corner, made a copy of the statement, and stuck it in my handbag.